Thank you for having me. My name is Robert, and today I'm going to tell you about provably efficient machine learning for a quantum many-body problem, which is a joint work with Richard Kuhn, Giacomo Torlai, Victor Albert, and John Preskill. Oops, sorry. So recently, machine learning have received a lot of attention in the quantum community. In particular, in this field on applying classical machine learning for quantum physics and quantum chemistry, the goal is to solve challenging quantum many-body problems using ML that hopefully could yield a solution better than traditional classical algorithms. However, despite the interest, many fundamental questions remain to be answered. In particular, one of the key questions that we would look into and in this talk is the following. So one might wonder, how can machine learning algorithms be more useful than non-machine learning algorithms in physically relevant problems? How could it, from a fundamental aspect, provide solutions better than non-machine learning algorithms? So in this talk, we will provide some concrete answer towards answering this question. So here's the outline. It provides a brief review on this classical shadow formalism that we developed last year, and then consider a combination of classical shadow formalism with modern machine learning technique in predicting ground states, as well as classifying quantum phases of matter. So let's begin with this classical shadow formalism. So the key question that we wanted to answer in classical shadow formalism is, how can classical machines see quantum many-body systems? And by seeing, what we mean is the ability to convert the quantum system, some unknown quantum system, to a classical form that could accurately capture many properties of the quantum system. So in this paper published last year, we proved the following theorem. We showed that there exists a procedure that could guarantee the following. So given two constant B and epsilon greater than zero, this procedure could learn a classical representation of an unknown quantum state rho by performing B log M over epsilon squared measurement, such that subsequently, given any observable O1 to OM with some norm bounded by B, the procedure can use the classical shadow, this classical representation to predict the expectation value of all of these observables up to epsilon error with high probability. So for example, if one wants to be able to measure 10 to the 6 different observable, all of which has a bounded norm of 1, then naively one would just perform measurements by just measuring each of the observable individually, which will require 10 to the 6 over epsilon squared measurement. However, this theorem shows that we actually only need 6 log 10 over epsilon squared measurement, which is a significant reduction from what one would need naively. Furthermore, this procedure is actually very simple. So given this unknown quantum system represented by this sphere with a bunch of different atoms in it, what we would do is we would apply a random unitary transformation onto the quantum system. So this random unitary would be sampled from some ensemble. After applying this random unitary, we would perform a computational basis measurement to measure every atom, every qubit, for example. So intuitively, one could think of it as the following picture. We have a high-dimensional object, which is the quantum system. By performing this random rotation followed by this measurement, we're essentially looking at this high-dimensional quantum system from different angle to get a classical sort of shadow of the high-dimensional quantum system. So that's why we called it the classical shadow formalism. And now given this classical representation, we have an algorithm for making prediction based on the data that we obtain. And then we can prove things about it, which resulted in this previous theorem that we show here. In particular, in this talk, we will utilize classical shadow formalism plus classical shadow representation based on randomized Pauli measurement. So a randomized Pauli measurement is very simple. For each qubit, you randomly apply a single qubit, a tensor product of single qubit Clifford unitary, followed by a computational basis measurement. So every time when you do the measurement, you will get a size of data that scales linearly in the system size. And after performing T rounds of randomized measurements, an n-qubit system rho would yield a classical shadow representation that looks like this. So basically each of this sigma ti, so this small t corresponds to different rounds, and this small I corresponds to which qubit. Each of this sigma ti, which is a 2x2 complex matrix, it corresponds to the measurement outcome, which based on what basis you measure, like based on the unitary that you applied, as well as the computational basis outcome, it will produce a 2x2 matrix that depends on these the basis as well as the measurement outcome. And then we just tensor product them together and take the average over the T rounds to generate this sigma T of rho. So as you can see, the sigma T of rho would be a 2 to the n by 2 to the n random matrix. Furthermore, one could prove that by doing a proper construction, the expectation value of this random matrix will be equal to the unknown state rho. But the nice thing about this representation is that it actually only needs little n, which is number of qubits, times capital T, the number of measurements you do, of bits to represent. So even though it's a very large random matrix, you represent it very succinctly by a polynomial number of bits. And furthermore, when you choose this capital T to be like this log m over epsilon squared, you can show that the resulting state, sigma T of rho, while it's a random matrix with the right expectation value, but there could be fluctuation. But the fluctuation will be very small when you wanted to predict a bunch of properties, like for example, correlation function, entanglement entropy in a constant size region, or local observables, Hamiltonian, et cetera. So basically, in this talk, we will always perform this kind of randomized measurement on this n-qubit quantum system to produce a classical representation that captures a lot of the properties of the original quantum systems. And all of these properties could actually be predicted very efficiently on a classical computer. So now we will dive into the first application. That is, we wanted to train a machine to be able to predict ground state. So here the task is the following. So we would have a parameter X that describes some Hamiltonian H of X. And what the machine has to do is it needs to predict the classical representation of the ground state rho of X that corresponds to the Hamiltonian H of X. So here this X is an m-dimensional vector where m is some hyperparameter, like how many variables that you have for describing this physical system. So for example, some coordinates of X could describe the laser intensity on different parts of the system, what is the few body interaction in the system, what is the magnetic field, et cetera. So basically, this X is just a parameter that describes the sort of the features that the experimentalist could control when preparing this physical system corresponding to the Hamiltonian H of X. Here we're going to assume that this mapping from X to H of X is not known exactly, which is common in experimental setting. And we will represent this rho of X on a classical computer using its classical shadow, which is written as sigma T rho of X, meaning that we have a quantum state rho of X. We perform T rounds of randomized Pauli measurement, and then we create this random matrix sigma T of rho of X. So more precisely, what the machine learning model has to do is it will be given a training data. So there will be a set of training data consisting of capital N different examples, which tells the machine that for this parameter XL, this is the corresponding classical shadow representation of the ground state, which is sigma T rho of XL. So in order to generate this training data, we probably have to go to the lab, prepare, synthesize some ground state or prepare some material or go to a fabrication lab to do some things and then perform some measurement to get this classical representation. And now you get this training data. So now with the training data, what the machine has to do is it has to learn from this training data such that when the machine is presented with a new parameter X that's not in the training data, it can accurately predict the classical representation of the ground state for this new parameter, which corresponds to a new physical system that people have not yet created in the lab. So now, after talking about the task, I will describe sort of what class of machine learning models we will consider in achieving this task. So recall that we have this training consisting of capital N different examples, each of which is a vector XL describing the physical system, mapping to the classical representation of the ground state. What we're going to do is we're going to consider training a machine learning model that takes in this m-dimensional vector and outputs this metric sigma hat of X, which is a pretty big matrix, but more precisely, we will consider outputting an efficient representation of this really large matrix. Furthermore, we will require that the machine learning model needs to be able to train within time that's polynomial in a system size small n, as well as small m. So here's one example of such a machine learning algorithm. Suppose we wanted to train a neural network in order to do this. So neural network has been pretty popular. Here we're going to consider a neural network where in the hidden layers, there's infinitely many neurons. And at the end, there's exponentially many neurons in the upper layer, which corresponds to this 2 to the n times 2 to the n matrix. So the input layer would have m neurons corresponding to the m dimensional vector. And this output 2 to the n by 2 to the n neurons will correspond to this representation for the ground state. So while this seems like a very, very large neural network model, we can actually train it in time polynomial in system size n and m as follows. Basically, using recent development in neural network theory, we can prove that when you consider the following loss function, so this is the L2 loss, it's the least square loss. What we consider is we have, so in a neural network, we have all these layers, all these connections, they correspond to some trainable parameters, which we represent by this capital W. We will train this parameterized function. We will train all of these weights by minimizing this cost function. So this cost function is essentially the difference between the output of the neural network, sigma hat W, minus the representation in the training data. So what we're going to do is we're going to minimize it. And one could prove that actually when you do gradient descent to minimize it, there is actually an analytical form for the optimal solution when you train this neural network. And actually you can write it out as, you can write out the final resulting function of the neural network after training as this form shown here. So basically this kappa is a learned function that depends on two parameters, the parameter X, which is the new parameter, and then this XL, which is the training data. And furthermore, this learned function kappa NNN can be obtained efficiently by some linear algebra computation. And actually not just for neural networks, there are also a lot of other machine learning models such as kernel methods, et cetera, that could all be shown to have this analytical form as the global minimum after training. Basically, you can show that for all of these different methods, the only difference is actually in this kappa. So this kappa is some kernel function or a learned function that tells how we should extrapolate from the known examples to the new point. So you can think of it as we have this entire space, the parameter space that corresponds to different physical system that would yield different ground state. And in the training data, we know some of the points in the space. So for example, we know x1, x2, x3, and x4. And now what all of these machine learning models do is it will find some function kappa such that when you're presented with a new x, it can compute some kind of a metric between x and x1, x and x2, and so on. And then the prediction of these methods is essentially equal to you utilize this function to perform an extrapolation. So each of this x1, x2, x3, x4 will be associated to this classical representation of the ground state, sigma t, rho of xl. And then you're just using this learned function to perform extrapolation to produce your prediction, sigma hat of x. So now after presenting, so now as long as this kappa function, this learned function kappa can be efficiently computed, then the prediction of the machine learning model can be represented efficiently using small n times capital T times capital N bits. The reason for that is because all of these random matrices, these random matrices, they only require small n times capital T bits to represent, and there's a capital N of them. So the prediction can also be represented very efficiently, and you can utilize this representation to predict these different kinds of properties that we discussed before, like the correlation function, expectation value of observables, et cetera. So after describing the sort of the framework for the algorithm, here's a rigorous theorem that we proved. So suppose we consider this ML model where we consider this learned function to be an L2 Dirichlet kernel, then we can prove the following theorem. We can show that for any smooth class of local Hamiltonians, H of X, in a finite spatial dimension with a constant spectral gap, given the number of training data, capital N, that's equal to some polynomial, and the number of parameters M. And we only need to consider one randomized measurement for each of the state, so T equal to one. We can show that the average prediction error for any sum of local observables would be bounded by a small constant epsilon, where the training and prediction time are both polynomial in the number of parameter M and linear in system size small n. So intuitively, one could think of these two conditions, the finite spatial dimension and this constant spectral gap, as saying that this smooth class of local Hamiltonians have to belong to a single quantum phase. So here are some of the key steps in the proof. The first one is to utilize this constant spectral gap and this finite spatial dimension to show some kind of a smoothness condition in the ground state space, which can be established using spectral flow plus Lie-Robinson bounds. And then based on this smoothness guarantee, you can prove a generalization error bound. So a generalization error bound is essentially how well does the machine learning model predicts for a new input. You can prove a generalization error bounds for this proposed machine learning model trained on this randomized measurement data, which is a combination of statistical analysis as well as a realization that when you have an m-dimensional sphere, the number of lattice points in an m-dimensional sphere actually of a constant radius m-dimensional sphere actually scales only polynomially in m rather than exponentially in m. And this number of lattice will determine like the VC dimension, which determines the generalization error bounds and so on. And that allows you to establish this theorem. So one of the limitations in the theorem is that this prediction error epsilon can only be a constant. In particular, when the epsilon becomes very small, the number of required training data will become very, very large. And note that up until now, what we are considering is a purely classical machine learning algorithms. There's no quantum computation involved. So one might wonder if a quantum machine learning algorithm could overcome this limitation. Could it yield a better sample complexity, for example? However, in the appendix of our paper, we proved that actually any quantum as well as classical machine learning algorithm all require a sample complexity that scales like n equal to m to the power of 1 over epsilon. So the advantage of quantum machine learning algorithm for this quantum task actually can only be a polynomial. So now we have established a result saying that we can accurately predict ground states using a classical machine learning algorithm. One might wonder if one could do it without the machine learning part. And the proposition one answers this question. So suppose there exists a classical polynomial time randomized algorithm that can predict the expectation value of any one local observables in any smooth class of local Hamiltonians to an error of 1/4, which is a constant error, in a two-dimensional spatial dimension with a constant spectral gap, then one could show that RP would be equal to NP, which meaning that NP complete problems can be solved in randomized polynomial time. So as a result of proposition one and the fact that people don't believe that NP complete problems can be solved, NP complete problems can be solved in randomized polynomial time, it means that no non-machine learning algorithm can achieve the same guarantee as the machine learning algorithm. So here's a nature question that one might ask. So why can machine learning algorithm be more useful than non-machine learning algorithm? The combination of theorem one and proposition one provides a concrete answer to this. So basically it shows that machine learning algorithm can be more powerful. And the reason is because for machine learning algorithm, it only has to generalize from the data. So for non-machine learning algorithm, it has to compute everything from first principle, but for machine learning algorithms, it already got these examples and all it has to do is to take those examples and generalize from it, which can be much simpler and much easier than computing everything from scratch. Oh, sorry, question.
Yes, can you elaborate what is non-machine learning algorithm?
Yeah, so basically that's a great question. So here, what we mean by machine learning algorithms are algorithms which are being supplied with data. So there are some data that could be obtained from more powerful computational resource. For example, if you take data from nature, because nature operates quantum mechanically, so you're essentially getting advice from a quantum mechanical computational thing. On the other hand, non-machine learning algorithms are algorithms that do not take in additional data during computation. So in some sense, one could think of it as these machine learning algorithms are algorithms with advice. So the advice are additional data that doesn't depend on your input, but could help you in your computation. So like in this P/Pauli complexity class. So that's sort of the intuition of it. Of course, here is kind of not exactly the same because the data actually depends on the phase, depends on the smooth class of local Hamiltonian. So it's not the same as P/Pauli. It's slightly stronger. It's actually much stronger than that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and then, so actually there's this one comment. It's basically these data contain computational power. For example, like I mentioned, nature operates quantum mechanically. So when you take data by performing experiments, those data, you might not be able to generate them efficiently on a classical computer because they have some BQP power inside of it. But when you have a machine learning model that could utilize those data, it can solve problems that cannot be solved using a non-machine learning algorithm that doesn't take in data. So the advantage of ML algorithms come from those data. The algorithm itself is still a classical Turing machine, but the data can be more powerful than a classical Turing machine, which is why we see the separation between theorem one and proposition one. So one might also be,
In the previous proposition, is two dimension important?
So actually, so one dimension, Thomas Wittig and other people, Zev Landau already had this results that says you can actually found the ground state efficiently, but actually, it has to be two or higher dimension such that the problem becomes hard.
So you need to use machine learning. So that machine learning is better.
Yes, the machine learning is better for like two or higher dimension. For one dimension, there's this rigorous algorithm, or you can just use DMRG in order to find it.
Is the gap important?
The gap, so you can think of it as the machine learning algorithm only works when it's a constant spectral gap. If it's inverse polynomially small spectral gap, then it doesn't work. At least the proof doesn't work. In practice, I'm not entirely sure, but at least the proof doesn't work. Okay. So that's quite important. Proposition one, it's basically a constant spectral gap is easier than when it's inverse polynomial. So that's indeed a constraint.
So
actually, it's still hard. It's still hard for non-machine learning algorithm, even if you consider constant spectral gap.
Maybe just a funny follow-up question. Suppose you define your system in some fractal with some fractional dimension larger than one.
Yes.
Does machine learning already have the advantage?
That's a great question. I think there were some results known. I think Neelin from MIT has some papers about fractal dimension, like dimension less than two, you can still solve the ground state efficiently or something like that. So maybe like 1.9 dimension, it's still not hard enough.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, Debbie has some question. Oh, okay, maybe not. Yep, so that's the theory part of predicting ground state. So one might also wonder how well does these proposed machine learning algorithm actually perform in real physical system. So that's what we're going to briefly go through in this part. So here we consider a very small training data size. It's a training size of 20 training points. And we consider 500 randomized measurements for constructing the classical shadow representation for each state. And we consider one of the best machine learning model chosen from a Gaussian kernel method, an L2 Dirichlet kernel method, and this infinite width neural network. So in figure B, we have this two-dimensional phase diagram. So in this example, there's only two parameters that characterize the system, the detuning and the interaction range. Then all of these gray points are the training data. And after training on them, we ask the machine to predict the ground state for these three markers. And the prediction is shown in figure C. The solid lines are computed by this computationally intensive DMRG. And the markers, the black markers, are the prediction from the classical ML. And you can see that it matches the prediction very accurately. On the other hand, you can also compare it with another naive strategy, where you just predict the nearest. So to say, predict this point, this cross, you might say, I will just consider the nearest training point and predict the ground state using the nearest training point. And you can see that the prediction is pretty bad, as shown here. On the other hand, if you use classical ML, it can track very accurately. Here's another example for a two-dimensional system. So here we consider a training data size of 100 and 500 randomized measurements each. The physical system we are going to consider is a two-dimensional anti-ferromagnetic random Heisenberg model, where the parameters are the coupling, between different qubits with different spins in the system. Here, in the left-hand side of figure B, we perform the snake-shaped DMRG, which actually the computational time scales exponentially in the width of the system. And then we compare with the ML prediction. So the ML prediction is very, very fast. You give him this 100 training data. Now you give him a new physical system. It would just make the prediction very quickly. So it's much, much faster than this DMRG. However, you can see that the prediction outcome looks very similar to the exact values computed from DMRG. So what we're showing here is actually the correlation function between spin I and spin j. So now that's the second part of the talk. In the last part of the talk, we will consider a different application where we train the machine to classify quantum phases of matter. So the task here is quite simple. Given a quantum state rho, we wanted to predict which quantum phases of matter the state rho is in. Here we're going to represent the quantum state using this classical shadow representation. And in the machine learning algorithm, we will provide him with a bunch of examples telling him that for this classical shadow, it's in trivial phase, and for that classical shadow of the state, it's in a symmetry broken phase, or if it's in a topological phase. And now given a new state that's not inside the training data, the classical ML algorithm have to predict which phase this new state is in. So essentially in this task, what the machine learning model has to do is to have to try to find a classifying function that separates the phases of matter. So for example, if you wanted to be able to classify a symmetry broken phase, there's typically a local observable O, such that in phase A, the expectation value is greater than zero, but in phase B is less than or equal to zero. In this case, for symmetry broken phases, it's very simple because the classical ML model only need to learn a linear function. You can just do that with a linear classifier, which is very simple. However, in proposition two, we proved that it is not possible to classify topological phases with linear function. Basically, one could show that if you have two distinct topological phases, A and B, there doesn't exist any observable, not even global observables that acts non-trivially on the entire system. There's just no observable that exists such that the expectation value for one phase is separated from the other phase. You can prove that by the definition of topological phase.
Question?
Yes.
Can you give an example of O for symmetry broken phase?
I think for example, the simplest example, I think, is the ferromagnet and the paramagnet case. In that case, I think you just pick this observable O to be the average of like sigma z. And then in one case, it would be greater than zero, but the other case is like zero.
But what does it mean to be less than zero?
Sorry?
If it's less than zero, is it significant? I mean, here you have only two cases. One is greater than zero. The other is less than or equal to zero. Do you mean the cases where it's less than zero and the case where it's equal to zero belong to the same phase?
Oh, you mean this?
Yeah. Maybe a short question. Is O just the order parameter?
Yeah. Oh, just the order parameter.
Then my understanding is you just check whether the expectation value of O is zero or non-zero, not whether it's positive or non-positive.
Right, that's true. You can also have the other side. So in that case, it's also not just a linear functions. That's true.
Okay.
But I think in some cases, even in the symmetry Birkin case, you also don't. But yeah, but basically, if you have a linear classifier, it has to look something like this, which you have a single line such that you can separate, like you have a single observable such that the expectation value could separate the two phases. And I think for some of the symmetry Birkin phase, you could find that. But for some symmetry Birkin phase, there's also no linear functions that could separate the two phases. So I think
okay.
Hope that kind of makes sense. But basically, the purpose of here is just to say that in particular for topological phase, there we have a rigorous proof saying that you just cannot use a linear function to separate between the two phases. If you wanted to be able to separate them, you have to consider some kind of nonlinear function in your quantum state. So I hope that's
maybe just to make sure, when you say linear or nonlinear function, is it a function of what?
It's a function of the state rho.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the entanglement entropy is an example.
Yes, entanglement not a linear function of state rho. It's a nonlinear function of state rho.
Thanks.
Okay.
Sorry, I have a question here, a clarifying question just about the statement. But suppose you have, isn't it true that when you have some of the topological phases have string operators, right, which don't depend on the state itself? For example, if there could be a one-form symmetry breaking rather than zero-form, those are topological phases, and there is a string order parameter for the
right. Yeah, that's a great question. Sorry. Okay. Here it's the topological order phase. It's not the symmetry protected topological phase.
I'm talking about topologically ordered phase without any zero form symmetry, but there could be some emergent one form symmetry at low energy. That's not a SPD phase. It's just for example, even in toric code, there could be some string order parameter whose expectation value.
No, I don't. For toric code, there's no like string order parameter type thing. Mm-hmm. It just couldn't exist. So that's the
in any gauge theory, there is Wilson loop operators which are string order parameters, and you can class at least for the Z2 gauge theory, there is a non-local order parameter, which is state independent, which distinguishes the confined phase from deconfined phase. And there's no symmetry requirement. It's just a topologically ordered phase it's not SPD, but just the.
Right. Yeah. Actually, John was also very confused by it. He said 30 years ago, he wrote a paper saying that you can distinguish certain topological phase with some kind of observable, but after we checked it, it's not true. I think when you consider this Wilson loops, they are actually not expectation value of observables.
Mm-hmm.
At least the example that he gave, it was actually like the absolute value of the expectation value, and you have to check the decay of it. So at least for like some torical example, in order to distinguish between two topological phases, you have to take the Wilson loops, and then, which is a string order, it is a non-local string order parameter. So you take the expectation value of that observable, you have to take the absolute value, and you have to check the decay of the absolute value when you increase the size of the
loop. Right, right. No,
it's
which
is not an observable in itself. It's not a linear function of the state. It's complicated non-linear function. So yeah,
thank you.
I think that that's the way to resolve the kind of the sort of the contradiction or the paradox. But yeah, but this proposition itself holds true. It's relatively easy to prove this proposition based on the definition of topological phase. So topological phase are defined as like two things, like two states are in the same phase if they're, like one way of defining it is two states are in the same phase if they could be connected by a constant depth quantum circuit. Or like if you can move from one state to the other state without closing the gap. And using that definition alone, you can already establish this proposition saying that there's just no linear function that satisfy this kind of criteria, which is a requirement for training like a linear machine learning model to classify things. So hope that's clear. But basically what it says is that based on this, in light of this proposition too, what we need is a more powerful machine learning model that can learn nonlinear function in order to classify more exotic type of phases of matter. So for example, we might need something like trace of O rho tensor rho, or trace of O rho tensor D, or even just a general analytic function f of rho, or even just a general function that might not even be analytic f of rho, to classify between the phases. In order to do so, what we consider is the following technique. Basically what we do is we consider learning a linear function in an infinite dimensional state where we take in each state rho, first map it to the classical shadow representation. Here I represent it as st of rho. Previously it's sigma t, but they're kind of similar. After mapping it into a classical representation, we map it into this infinite dimensional space that of this form. So what it's doing is, in this part, we're essentially using a classical shadow formalism to estimate the approximate reduced density matrix for a subsystem consisting of qubits I1 to IR. And then in this part, we concatenate all the R-body subsystems. Here we concatenate all sizes of different subsystems. Here we take a degree D polynomial expansion. So when we train a linear function in this vector, this high dimensional vector, is equivalent to training a polynomial function in the underlying reduced density matrices. And finally, we concatenate all degree. So it could learn arbitrarily smooth function, essentially. So basically this mapping consists of arbitrary large R-body reduced density matrices and arbitrary high degree polynomial expansion. And then we are learning a linear function in this, which is equivalent to learning a highly nonlinear function in the underlying state rho. And basically, one might wonder how to train such an infinitely large model. Basically, we're going to utilize this technique called kernel trick, which says that all we have to do is to be able to efficiently compute the inner product between two of these infinite dimensional vectors, which can indeed be done very easily by doing some manipulation and Taylor expansion kind of organization. You can show that the inner product can be represented by this very simple form, which can be computed in time, linear in system size, and quadratic in the number of randomized measurements you take. So basically, given two different state rho and rho tilde, we can compute the inner product of this infinite two, like we map this two quantum state into two infinite dimensional vector, we can compute the inner product of these two infinite dimensional vector very efficiently using this formula, which we also refer to it as the shadow curve. So after designing this, if you wanted to train a linear function in this infinite dimensional space, it only take time polynomial in system size, in the number of randomized measurement, and in training data. Furthermore, we can prove the following theorem. We show that if there exists a nonlinear function of few body reduced sensing matrices that could be used to classify the phases, then the classical algorithm can learn to classify these phases accurately using an amount of training data and computational time that scales polynomially in system size. Furthermore, this ML model will construct this classifying function explicitly, so you can just look at it and understand how this machine learning model is classifying the phases. So there are some examples that could classify functions on few body reduced sensing matrices, assuming this constant spectral gap. For example, in a 1D Haldane phase, you have this twist operator, which you can prove that you don't need the twist operator to span the entire system. You only have to act on a few body reduced sensing matrices, and you can already classify phases with it. Another example is Hall conductivity, which is a low degree polynomial. So it's not a linear function, it's a low degree polynomial for classifying phases. Finally, I think the most famous example is topological entanglement entropy, which is a nonlinear function. It's not even an analytic function, it's just a nonlinear function that you can use to classify topological phases. And that also falls into theorem two, meaning that when you train this machine learning model, it will be able to classify, let's say, toric phase versus the trivial phase. As long as such a classifying function exists, the machine learning model is guaranteed to find it. Furthermore, we've chatted with some quantum information / condensed matter theorists, and I think they are trying to prove that actually for any topological phase, there always exists a nonlinear function of few body reduced sensing matrices for classifying phases. I think Anna has some question.
Thank you. I'm just thinking towards application of this framework. And I was wondering, I presume you would have maybe an experimental lab that actually has data and wants to classify their data sets using what you've developed. Would the research community then accept a statement such as this is so-and-so such a phase based on what this algorithm, this ML algorithm predicted, or would the research community want more of a physical argument or proof that this is indeed such a phase? Like, would people accept what the ML algorithm outputs?
That's a great question. At least for me, I think if I'm going to use it for understanding the phases, I think this technique would be more of like, we can apply it and then it would find some classifying function. And then I could look at what that classifying function is. And at least for me, I would try to look at what it is and prove that it actually classified phases. So at least that would be how I will utilize it in an application setup. Or yeah, I think that's a...
Okay, so have you seen functions come out of this that you weren't expecting?
That's a great question. So for one of the experiments, like for example, for here, it seems like it can classify between these two phases from a much fewer number of experiments than one would originally expect by performing, really estimating topological entanglement entropy. So one thing that we're doing as a follow-up is to try to understand what is this explicitly, what this function is, and whether we can prove that that function could actually be used to classify topological phases. Basically, what it's doing here is kind of like it's learning a quadratic function. So like a trace of O row tensor row. We wanted to prove that actually you can find a quadratic function that can indeed classify topological phases. So that will be one. We haven't proved that yet. We just see that it seems to be sufficient for classifying phases, and the machine learning model can find a reasonable one. But proving it is quite hard. So the proof is not there yet, but at least it seems like this is something that people haven't considered before, because typically for classifying these topological order phase and trivial phase, we need like this topological entanglement entropy, which is a highly nonlinear function rather than just a quadratic function in the underlying state. So that will be one example that I've observed. But yeah, but proving things is kind of harder, so.
Yeah, and I was just wondering, because I mean, in typical applications of ML in like non-physics, you actually want to classify large amounts of data, but here we're, I suppose, more trying to learn something about the system. So it's a different motivation.
Right. Yes.
Sorry, one more question.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure you in this algorithm, you do not need to tell the machine what the function is, right?
Yes, yes. You don't need to tell him. That's so, what it's trying to learn. Function
reclassifying. So basically you are saying, for example, for a topological order, your algorithm is able to find all topological invariants that can distinguish all different topological orders?
The theorem is slightly different. The theorem is saying that as long as there exists a nonlinear function of few body reduced sensory matrices that could classify these different topological phases, then the method is going to find it. But I don't think it has been rigorously established whether you can always use a nonlinear function of few body reduced sensory matrices to classify phases. I think people work, like some theorists work on it, believe it's true, but they are still working hard to prove this condition, so.
My understanding of the study of topological orders is, at the moment, people don't know the full set of topological invariants in general.
Right, that's true, yes.
So what do you mean by few body here?
Oh, it just meant like, it acts on
locally.
It acts on a constant number of qubits.
I see.
Like for example, you compute the topological entanglement entropy in a constant region. That would be an example.
But if you just study the topological entanglement entropy in a constant size region, then you may have some significant error, right?
So it depends on the spectral gap. If you start closing the spectral gap, then the correlation length will grow. Uh-huh. And as the correlation length grow, you need a bigger and bigger region in order to reduce this error that you talked about. However, if it's just a constant spectral gap, such that the correlation length is localized, then you just need the region that's bigger than the correlation length, which would also be a constant size region.
Yeah, but I guess you need it to be much bigger to eliminate the error. Not just
that is true.
Then suppose you don't know the correlation length and you apply this machine learning algorithm and mm-hmm. you find some topological entanglement entropy. Then it may have some error. So then there's the problem of how to interpret it, right?
I see.
It may not correspond to the true topological entanglement entropy. You may have to increase the size of each subregion.
Right. That is true. But you will see. Basically, if you need larger correlate, like if you need the body to be larger, then you need to feed in more training data to the algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't feed in enough training data, you will see that it wouldn't accurately classify the phases.
Okay, thanks.
Like the prediction, like basically you're saying this error, right? Like when this is not enough, then there's error. The error is the error in your classification. So basically it means that when you just apply this method to classify new states, it will not classify it accurately if the correlation length is not enough. But actually the method that we have is adaptive. So basically if you need larger correlation length, it will find larger correlation length. You don't need to specify how big the correlation length is and so on. You just need to give him sufficient number of data such that based on those data, it's possible to classify the phases. Then this method will classify it.
Accurate. Okay. Then this view body may not really be view body, right? According to what you just said, the machine doesn't need to know the correlation length. So the machine a priori will assume the correlation length may be as large as possible. And this view body thing may just be a many body thing.
Right. So it could be, it doesn't have to be like 3 or 4.
You are really saying this algorithm can find all possible topological invariants for all topological orders.
Right, but there's an important thing is that the number of body, like how big this region is, will affect the, if you need a very big region in order to classify accurately, then the training data and the computational time will both grow. And
I guess what I find most fascinating is conceptually people don't know the full set of for topological invariants for all topological orders, and you are saying your algorithm can find it. I think this is fascinating.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, so that's the theory part of it. And here are some numerical experiments similar to before, where we showed that we can actually apply these kind of proposed machine learning algorithms in actual physical systems. So here is an example for a one-dimensional symmetry. This is a one-dimensional bound alternating XXC model, which has a phase diagram that looks like this. There are 3 different phases. And in figure C and D, we consider 2 slices. So if one slice over delta equal to 0.5, and in figure D, we consider this slice for delta equal to 3.0. For 0.5, there are 2 different phases, a trivial phase and a topological phase. And in delta equal to 3.0, there are 3 different phases, a trivial phase, symmetry broken phase, and a topological phase. Here we are considering an unsupervised version of the machine learning model that we propose. So unsupervised meaning that you don't need to tell him a labeled training data. You don't need to tell him whether this state corresponds to that phase. You just give him a bunch of different states, and we will utilize again this shadow kernel to perform classification of the phases. Particularly, the output of the algorithm will be a low dimensional representation. Here we're presenting a 2-dimensional representation of how the machine learning model sees the state. It's basically states in the same phase will be grouped together and so on. So in figure C, you can see that this 2-dimensional representation found by the machine learning model correctly groups the trivial phase and the topological phase. And for states that are in the critical points, you can see that it's being placed slightly in the middle of these 2 clusters. For delta equal to 3.0, there are 3 different phases. And as you can see, the machine learning model also finds these 3 cluster that corresponds very exactly to the 3 different phases. Here's another example for 2-dimensional system. The data here, the states we consider here is a toroidal ground state subject to a constant depth random circuit, as well as a product state subject to a constant depth random circuit. So what we do is we sample a bunch of points in a topological phase by considering toroidal ground state, add some fluctuation, trivial product state, add some fluctuation, and then we get this collection of states, and we just feed it into the machine learning model, and the machine learning model will try to find the phases in terms of a 1-dimensional representation shown in figure B. Is there a question? Okay, so the x-axis is the depth of this random circuit. And the y-axis shown here is this 1-dimensional representation. So as you can see, when the depth is short, the 2 phases are well separated and the machine learning model can accurately classify between the 2 of them. However, when the depths start to go high, then the 2 phases actually get collide together because you can no longer distinguish them. And you can see that they got mixed up. In figure C, this is a classification accuracy of the machine learning model. For short depths, you can see that this shadow method, which is an unsupervised machine learning model, have 100% accuracy. On the other hand, we also compare it with a more traditional machine learning algorithm for classifying some phase. So there have been works by people to classify phases using classical ML. One of them was to use convolutional neural network to do it. But actually, one could show that if you train a convolutional neural network based on the measurement data to classify the two phases, it's actually equivalent to finding an observable to classify between the two phases. And due to proposition two, you can show that it's impossible to classify the two phases using a linear function, using just an observable. So that's why when you apply this convolutional neural network, you see that the classification accuracy suddenly drops to 0.5, meaning that it's pretty much the same as just random guessing. On the other hand, if you feed in convolutional neural network with this classical shadow representation, now it has the ability to learn higher order function, nonlinear function of the quantum state, and then you can see that the performance becomes much higher. Is there a question?
In these graphs on your x-axis for circuit depth, what is the unit you're using? Like it's going from 0 to 1, right?
So it's a circuit depth over the code distance. So here I'm considering a toric code with a code distance of 10.
Okay.
So it would be a 200 qubit toric code state. And the circuit depth is actually just 0 to 9.
Right.
At most 9 layers of random circuit.
I see. Okay, thank you.
So to conclude, we've proved that classical machine learning algorithms informed by data from physical experiments can effectively address some quantum many-body problems. And as a consequence of theorem one and proposition one, we established the advantage of classical ML models over classical non-ML algorithms in a physically relevant task. And some, there are a lot of interesting open questions that would be nice to study. For example, what are the advantage of ML over non-ML algorithms in other kind of tasks? Could we prove rigorous guarantee for other quantum many-body problems using classical ML? And in particular, so far we've been talking about classical machine learning algorithms for quantum problems. Are there an interesting class of quantum problems such that we can utilize quantum machine learning algorithms to yield an exponential advantage over classical machine learning algorithms? So that's it for my talk. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you a lot, Shin, for the nice talk. If anyone has any questions, you can unmute yourself and ask. Arun?
Thank you. Yeah, a very nice talk. I had two quick questions.
Yeah.
One is, did you try looking at, maybe so far you haven't, if you take say toric code, consider a transition between toric code and some double Samyon model so that the topological entanglement entropy is same. So then maybe you can, did you check that the machine knows about topological spin of the anions?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And we're actually, Victor and I, and also Isaac Kim, we're trying to generate data in order to feed in and check it. We haven't really done it yet. So that's definitely a very interesting thing to check.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but as long as there exists a, but I think that there does exist a nonlinear function.
But it may give some insight into how to maybe, I don't know, what kind of data helps with what kind of nonlinear function. I don't know. I mean,
right, yeah. Right.
But another question I had was, is there any progress on understanding classifying phases when the distinction is not in the ground state, but in dynamics? Let's say I give you a chaotic phase and a many-body localized phase, which is so the maybe ground state doesn't capture the distinction between them, but time evolution does. Is there any similar results for those things?
Ah, I haven't looked into that, so I don't think there is any results there yet.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Where results talking and learning for those kind of things. I think that's a very interesting question.
Tim?
Hi, yeah, nice talk. I pretty much had the same question as Tarun. Basically, even before the ML approach, if you look at your classical shadow of Torah code versus double semian, I would guess that they look very similar.
Uh-huh.
So have you even just looked at even before the ML, just looking at the shadows of these two phases?
I see. Yeah, so there are some, so we have been thinking about it, but there are a little bit, like for example, here we are looking at like square lattices, but I think for double semion, you have to look at some more like hexagon type of lattice rather than just square lattice. Otherwise, it's not well-defined or something like that. So there are a little bit of problems in that front, but as long as they're, I mean, they should be, yeah, but if I remember correctly, I think there are features locally that could be used to distinguish the two phases, right? So
they have different anion content, but
right.
Accessing that locally seems not obvious, right? Like
That's true.
I guess more generally, you know, double semion is an example of a model with a fundamental sign problem. Like, uh-huh. Have you thought about whether phases with the sign problem are harder to learn?
Yeah, I think it depends on sort of when you look at these local reduced density matrices, do they reveal themselves in some way? I think they do, because if you just pick a local region, I mean, you cannot, of course, pick just a few cube, maybe one or two qubit, that's probably not enough. But I think if you just pick a local region, there would be some signs that's already existing inside that local region when you pull out, like you take the reduced density matrices of that local region, right? So I do feel like it's possible to distinguish it, but as you said, it might be harder, but how harder it is, Is it just a constantly harder, or is it really asymptotically harder and stuff like that? I'm not entirely sure about that, but that does seem quite interesting. But do you expect that it would be asymptotically different, or it feels like it's just a constant difference. Like you just take the reduced density matrices of a constant region, and now you can already see the sign, like the phase information in that reduced density matrices. So
right.
Of course, due to the entanglement, it would be slightly mixed, but within that mixture, you will see this kind of phase difference. Like on the one hand, it's always the same phase, but on the other hand, maybe when you switch some of the configuration, you will see that the phase is slightly different. So it does feel like it will reveal itself, but I'm not entirely sure. So.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Tim, about your question, if I just want to distinguish Torah code and double semion, then I can just do self-breeding to check the self-statistics, right? That's local.
You need to do some breeding?
I just exchange to suppose the machine knows to create two identical excitations and exchange them and measure the resulting phase. That's a local process.
Sure. But you know, this classical shadow thing formed from, you know, some random local unitary with Pauli measurement. Is this braiding built into that? I mean, that'd be pretty amazing, right? Like,
but I thought this algorithm is so powerful that it can identify all possible topological invariants. It's actually more powerful than I expected. That sounds really
I think so. Yeah, my intuition is that it should be possible, but maybe it requires more data than just classifying between trivial and And like here, I only use 500, which is very small when I talk to experimentalists. They said like, like this is literally just performing 500 measurement. So there's a bunch of fluctuation, but it's still sufficient. I think in your case, if you wanted to be able to implement a little bit of local kind of rating kind of things, then you probably need more than just 500, maybe 10,000 or something like that in order to get enough statistics so you can do local rating. But I do feel like, yeah, like, but I think an interesting question is how much more do we need when we wanted to perform this kind of things? Because like, even though it sounded kind of strange that we're just doing like this random measurement, in principle, if you do sufficient number of random measurement, you can construct an entire state. Of course, that would be exponential number of random measurement. So that's not very good, but yeah, but this random measurement thing, they could, if you just keep doing that measurement, you will get every information you can from the state. So.
Just one comment here. I think just on this question about braiding, my understanding is that it has been proved by, I don't know, Bowen and Isaac that the density matrix of a disk is enough to know everything, at yes. least. So then, I mean, you can say maybe in a hidden way, maybe you are doing some creating excitations, but maybe you don't have to even think in those language of going to excitation. Somehow it's there. The whole string net rules are encoded in this procedure. Why?
Yeah, I think that's a great, yeah. When I say some theorists, I actually meant Isaac and Bowen Shi and also Coltello and yeah, these three people who are working on these front. I think from, I just chatted with them like 2 weeks ago, and I think they are claiming that they're going to, I mean, their hope is to prove that for any phases, you can always just use the reduced density matrices and some nonlinear function will exist such that you can classify all possible phases. That's their goal. I'm not sure how close they are to proving that. But if they did prove that, then combining with theorem two of this result, then basically it established that this classical machine learning algorithm can learn to classify any topological phases.
Right. And I think lastly, they were, like, sorry. Yeah.
Right.
No, it was just, please go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, no, and I think in this paper that you mentioned, I think it was already published. I think they did study that and they showed that like another application regarding this ML is that like people might be able to prove that, but maybe when they prove it, they are not finding the simplest nonlinear function to classify the phases. But the thing about this ML thing is that it will find the most efficient method for classifying it due to the optimization algorithm that it's performing. It will, yeah, because it's trying to maximize the prediction accuracy by utilizing the limited data it has. So right. It potentially finds even much simpler functions than the ones that people use to prove the statement. So maybe when you prove the statement, it's a constant region, but maybe it's still very highly nonlinear and very crazy function and so on, but potentially this algorithm could provide a more economical way such that you can actually implement it in actual physical systems so that when you created some physical systems, you can have a reasonable method for really classifying which phase is in and so on. So that, I think that's another application which I remember someone was asking, maybe Anna was asking about the application. So I think that's another application of these machine learning algorithms.
I guess on that note, there is even a paper by Bowen and collaborators last week on a specific nonlinear function to extract the Carrier central charge.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can check that also. Does your...
I think Victor is also on that paper, right?
Yeah.
We were talking 2 weeks ago about that result. So we were also thinking about those kind of front and so on. Mm-hmm. Seems interesting.
Any more questions from the audience? So I have a question. So you had defined cost function as the squared error function.
You mean in the first application?
Yeah, I guess, yeah. So I don't know much about machine learning, but I had read somewhere like in logistic regression, using this squared error as the cost function, like this is a non-convex function. So there are local minima and maxima. So optimization is not easy. So they use some log function actually, which is probably a convex function, and that's why there exists a global minima and optimization is easier. So I was wondering like...
You're wondering like if you choose some other cost function, could it become much easier and so on? So interesting note is that when you take this number of neurons into infinite, it actually makes the optimization landscape much nicer. So The optimization for this is actually convex. I'm not entirely sure if you change this square loss into some different loss, will it maintain? I think it should be fine. It will probably still be convex and you can still find it. But I'm not sure if it will make how much difference it would make. At least from a theory perspective, I think it might change some of the constant. If you change from B square loss to some different loss, maybe some other loss is better by a constant, but analytically, it's a little bit hard to pinpoint what that constant is because in the theoretical statements, it's often just an upper bound and it's often quite a loose upper bound. So in practice, it's going to perform much better. But I think that's an interesting question to understand if changing it to a different loss will actually improve the performance or it's actually pretty similar and so on. So
in the end, you had another example where you showed that CNN supervised with perhaps actual density matrix didn't have a good classification, but when you used shadow state, then it provided a much better classification. Was that
a shallow what? Sorry, a shallow state?
In towards the end, you had a slide where you showed.
I
remember the number. Like there was CNN supervised. So for that, classification was 0.5 classification accuracy. And then when you have CNN using classical shadow, I guess, then the accuracy is much better.
Right. The reason for, are you asking why is that? Or
Yeah,
the reason for that is because so here in the CNN, what it does is I'm following, so basically Giacomo Torlai, who has worked a lot on this machine learning for quantum physics kind of application. Previously, what people would do is they would perform some information complete POVM on your state to gather some classical data, feed it into CNN, which is a nonlinear function in your measurement outcome, to make prediction. While that the CNN itself is nonlinear, if you look at that entire process as a function of the quantum state, it's actually a linear function in the quantum state. So basically, taken a measurement outcome, you apply a nonlinear function on the measurement outcome to produce one observable, like a real value O. When you average over this measurement outcome, you can see that it's actually a linear function in your original density matrix row. So basically, if you just train a CNN to do it, what you're going to do is you're finding a linear function to classify between these two topological phases. And from proposition two, such that there's no linear function, there's no single observable that could be used to classify two distinct topological phases, and that's why it fails miserably. However, there's no problem with convolution neural network. It's a perfectly fine method. It's actually the step of what people do before is they do this like information complete POVM to get the classical data and feed it in. That part is, that's where it's limiting it. So basically what we do in the shadow case is we perform a bunch of measurement to create this classical shadow-like thing, which is a technique that enables you to predict like nonlinear function of your underlying density matrix. So now if you train a convolutional neural network on this shadow outcome rather than just this information complete POVM outcome, you can learn nonlinear function. And that's why in the star case, you can see a significant improvement in the performance.
Thanks a lot. So Sriram has a question.
Yeah, so I mean, for classification, like, have you tried these support vector machines, like pre-neural network stuff?
Right. Actually, when I talk about this kernel method, support vector machine is a type of kernel method.
Exactly, infinite dimensional kernel.
Right. 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 Right.
Right. Right. But so that can be done even without a neural network, right? I mean, could you? Like just to formulate the entire problem as some convex optimization, identify a kernel in that, and then optimize.
Yeah, so as you can see, this guy, Gaussian kernel method, I wrote that because, okay, so support vector machine is used for like binary classification, kind of more like in a phase case, like in a phase classification. But here, this is, you wanted to predict like a real value essentially. So it's not quite a normal support vector machine. And also we are combining it with this kind of method where your output is actually a matrix representing your state. So that's why we just call it a kernel method. But basically you can think of it as an adaptation of like this Gaussian kernel method and this L2 Dirichlet kernel method as an adaptation of this support vector machine for predicting ground state. And this infinite with neural network is an adaptation of the current neural network models for predicting ground state. So I'm comparing all three of them here. So what I could also briefly mention what I found here. So first of all, I proved results regarding L2 Dirichlet kernel, but in practice, I found this to perform the worst. Gaussian kernel and infinite with neural networks actually perform better. So that's empirically what I found, meaning that potentially we could also prove results regarding this. And these two methods seems to perform, like sometimes neural network performs slightly better. I think for this random Heisenberg model, neural network performs slightly better. But for this Rydberg-Adam case, I think Gaussian kernel method performs slightly better. But the difference is not that great. Which also kind of makes sense in the sense that in the pre-neural network case, people don't have a lot of data and people actually have compared the support vector machine with neural networks and they found support vector machine to often work better than neural networks in a wide range of different tasks. Mm-hmm. And the current days, there's much more data. They consider data of 10 to the 6 or like 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6. Like the training set is that large. It's very, very large. And that's the case where people found neural network to be much better in those kind of larger data regime. But here we're only considering 100, so.
So this is like a question. So in a machine learning model, how do you understand computational complexity? I mean, of course, often you deal with accuracy. I mean, how do you compare in the, I mean, the computational hardness of one model versus another?
I see. Typically you can also analyze machine learning model just like a normal algorithm. You can analyze, for example, if you consider like support vector machine, then it's a convex optimization. So you just analyze how long does it take for the convex optimization to find a global minimum. On the other hand, for neural network, it's much harder to perform analysis because you don't know, like because the landscape is often non-convex, so it's harder to analyze the computational complexity because sometimes it goes to a local minimum, but then due to some noise, it jumps out and then it goes to a better local minimum and so on. In that case, it becomes much harder to analyze. However, the situation we consider here is that we are considering this, we're utilizing some recent technology or technique called neurotension kernel, which actually set the neural network such that the optimization landscape is convex. So you can analyze the computational complexity of such algorithm. So mm-hmm. Hope that makes sense.
Thank you.
Another question?
Yeah, thanks. So I'm trying to think of like any possible phase where there isn't a nonlinear function that distinguishes it. So could it be that these fracton phases offer some example? Like, it seems like distinguishing or trying to identify if there's a fractal logical operator might be kind of hard based on local data.
I see. I mean, I don't know. I've also asked Isaac about a similar question, and then his answer was something like the following. He said, which I also think kind of makes sense. He said, you can informationally, if you don't think of computationally, but informationally, when you have local reducency matrices, you have enough information to construct the underlying Hamiltonian. And if you can construct the underlying Hamiltonian, you learn everything about the entire physical system. So even in this fractal model, I think he would say that, using just reduced sensing matrices should be enough to classify between this fracton phase and other kind of phases. So at least that's my, when I chatted with him, I think that was, at least that's what they believe. I think they wanted to say that for any kind of strange quantum phases, there always exists a method that takes in only reduced sensing matrices and could already be useful to make prediction.
Okay.
Of course, the computational is another issue. Like, for example, if you go through that route, I think Isaac has a paper on like if you take in reduced sensing matrices, then you can construct the Hamiltonian. But I think the complexity was really, really bad. It's not efficient at all. And furthermore, if you can really construct the Hamiltonian efficiently, how do you get the Hamiltonian and infer the phase? That's another difficulty. So maybe this nonlinear function of few body reduced sensing matrices is, it depends. Yeah, the complexity of that can be, it's unclear what is the complexity of that nonlinear function.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's possible that you can, like informationally, it should be enough to classify phases, but computationally, that's a different problem. And actually, regarding that, I should also mention it. So here, when I say a nonlinear function, I actually have defined sort of a metric for measuring the complexity of the nonlinear function. And that complexity have to be sort of bounded, cannot be like super crazy. Otherwise, the computational time is not going to be efficient. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Can I maybe add some comments, maybe about Tim's question? So
yeah,
I think from another aspect about this point is like, even for this kind of exotic model, like fractal model, there's still a local, like a exact tensor network representation for this kind of model, in the sense that local AD information is encoded in the individual local tensor. So it may not be too surprising, like the view body with this tensor matrix is enough to capture some universal information.
I see. Yeah, that's a great comment.
Yeah. Do we have any questions? If not, let us thank Shin for a great talk.